Case number 12-7077, Charles Singletary v. District of Columbia Appellant. Ms. Alakon for the appellant, Mr. LaCard for the appellee.
Yes.
That's the way you like it.
Come on. Thank you. What do you do? Did you get heard in the magistrate's court? This is hard to do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lauren Alakon, and I represent the District of Columbia. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sure you're disappointed to learn that crowd wasn't here to hear your argument.
It's true. Under well-established law, a municipality cannot be held liable under Section 1983 on the basis of respondeat superior. But that is precisely what the district court did here, which requires reversal and entry of summary judgment on liability in the district's favor, and at the very least, requires remand for a new trial on liability and damages. Under Monell, a municipality is liable only where the violation arises from a municipal custom or policy. But the district did not have a policy of revoking parole based on unreliable hearsay or otherwise insufficient evidence, and thus Mr. Singletary's claim seeks to hold the district liable for the discretionary, quasi-judicial action of the parole board in revoking parole on the specific facts of Mr. Singletary's case.
Now, can I ask you this question? If the mayor had done it, then I take it you wouldn't take issue with the notion that municipal liability could attach.
Here, the mayor had delegated policymaking authority to the chairperson subject to review period by the council, and so I believe the district would still take the position that the mayor, in the course of revoking parole on specific facts of the case, would not be establishing municipal policy for purposes of Monell liability.
Even though let's assume away the delegation to the board chair and assume just that the way that the regime worked is, well, let's make it easier. Suppose the city council did it. City council revokes parole. Then I take it under the Supreme Court's decisions about you can have municipal liability even if it's a one-time event.
Yes, you can. Under Pembauer, you can.
And if so, you have the right rank of official.
Absolutely.
And so if the city council did it, then I take it municipal liability could attach.
It could attach, but it wouldn't necessarily attach. The city council would be the final policymaking authority in your hypothetical, and under Pembauer, a single action of someone with authority to make final policy can give rise to liability. However, it would still be a question of whether or not the mayor was making policy when he revoked the parole. Here, the mayor, presumably if he was doing what the parole board did, was not passing on the ability to rely on unreliable hearsay. He was just revoking the parole based on the specific facts in Mr. Singletary's case.
But I don't understand that distinction, because I thought the whole point of saying that a one-time event could trigger municipal liability is precisely that you don't need to have an abstract policy in the sense that it seems to me your answers are suggesting.
No. Forgive me, Your Honor. I think what it means is under Pembauer, it was an isolated act, but it was a policymaking decision by the county prosecutor who was authorized in that case to make policies governing law enforcement. So you have officers that go into this office. They say, we don't know if we're allowed to execute this warrant to get these witnesses that we believe are in this office. They call the sheriff. The sheriff says, well, I don't know. It's my policy to contact the county attorney who has statutory authority to make policy in that arena. They then called him. He made a decision, and that was held to be policy. Here, if the mayor was just granting or revoking parole on the facts of a particular case, I think there'd be an open question as to whether or not he was actually making policy.
So you think that the nature of this decision is such that it can never give rise to municipal liability, even if the city council doesn't?
No, I think that there could be cases in which the policy was invoked. So let's say Mr. Singletary says, I object to the use of hearsay testimony at my hearing because I don't think it's appropriate. And the city council sitting in your hypothetical as the parole revocation board says, we think that's appropriate to rely on this hearsay testimony. That could be a policy. But here what we have is a quasi-judicial action about whether or not the facts establish a violation of parole for Mr. Singletary. There was no question about whether or not the hearsay should or shouldn't be admitted, and there was no indication that the policy or the parole board was even thinking about that question. They were just trying to determine whether the facts established the threshold finding that there had been a probable or other preponderance of the evidence that parole should be revoked. And so I think where maybe you and I are joining issue is that the council in your hypothetical could be enacting policy if there were indications that it was actually doing so through its action. But just because someone has final policymaking authority doesn't render every decision they make policy for purposes of municipal liability under Monell.
So if it's a hiring and firing decision, for example, by someone who has policymaking authority over hiring and firing, what you'd say is even if the decision is unconstitutional, that if they didn't articulate the firing decision in such a way that it purports to establish some general policy, then there still wouldn't be municipal liability?
No, not at all. I think under Pembauer and Poprotnick, if you have the hiring and firing authority is vested within someone, they make a decision. That decision is, in fact, a decision of the district carrying out policy.
So then why isn't – I don't understand the difference then. Here, the city council would be in the same position. They'd be in a position to make policy about revocation decisions.
Because there, the decision is necessarily part and parcel of the employment policy. Here we have the Parole Commission sitting as a quasi-judicial body. They're determining the facts of a particular case. And so I think there's something more that's required than the mere fact that they're ruling on the case to give rise to an inference that they're making policy when revoking parole on specific facts. There, I think it turns more on the quasi-judicial nature of what the Parole Commission is doing, as opposed to just someone with hiring and firing authority making a decision carrying out that authority.
This seems to me a very simple case. And tell me where... If I'm missing something here, but the district has a rule promulgated before the delegation that requires a preponderance of the evidence, right? The Supreme Court has held, and numerous circuit courts have held, that within the preponderance of the evidence standard is a requirement of reliability and probative value. Supreme Court's held that, numerous circuits have held it. What happened here, according to our decision, is that the parole board violated that preponderance standard because they took evidence and relied on it that was not reliable evidence. It was hearsay, but it wasn't reliable hearsay. But the policy still stands, and therefore, under Monell, there can be no municipal liability. Why isn't that the end of the case?
We think that could be the end of the case, Your Honor. Mr. Singletary disputes
that. But it hasn't been quite argued that way. I think it was argued that way in the district court better than it's been argued up here.
Well, in our briefs on appeal, we submit that to the extent that the board was relying on unreliable hearsay, that would be in violation of the regulations governing parole, and so that the policy is what's in 28 DCMR 217 to 219, which is completely accordant and, I believe, parrots the language of Morrissey. And so the policy was not to rely on unreliable hearsay. I think that's where I started my argument today. The district did not have a policy of relying on unreliable hearsay or otherwise insufficient evidence in revoking parole.
Had a policy just the opposite of that.
Exactly.
The preponderance of the evidence standard requires an assessment based on reliable evidence, and the courts are uniform in that.
And then
the parole board violated that standard.
Now that becomes a very short opinion in our favor, and if that's the route this court would like to go.
Did the overarching preponderance standard, did it say anything about hearsay?
No, it did not.
Okay.
So Morrissey itself doesn't even say anything about hearsay testimony. It just provides a right to confront witnesses absent good cause, and that's precisely what the
hearsay
D.C. regulation says.
Hearsay testimony is permissible when parole revocation.
Absolutely. Right. It just needs to have sufficient indicia of reliability.
So is the logic of this then that if you have an individual hiring and firing decision that's undertaken by the city council, and there's a policy in effect that says we only undertake city hiring and firing decisions that are constitutional and that have the appropriate trappings. But then somebody on the city council undertakes a decision that's in derogation of that policy, that there wouldn't be municipal liability because of the existence of the policy?
Well,
then maybe that's the law, but
I believe, yes, what the district's position would be in that is that there is a policy and the council would have been acting in contravention of that policy. Now, I believe that Mr. Singletary would come in and say, in that action, they were creating new policy which superseded the previous constitutional policy. And so I think that's where there might be this inquiry into whether or not the parole board here had final policymaking authority when they were revoking the parole and the facts of his case. But they certainly weren't exercising any authority to regulate the use of hearsay in parole revocation proceedings writ large.
Would you think it relevant to the answer of Judge Srinivasan's question that there might be an action, but it would not be a constitutional tort action, that it would be under some of the employment statutes if the facts involved the hypothetical posed by Judge Srinivasan?
I suppose it very well could be. If the action was taken in violation of Title VII, there might be some course of action there, but it wouldn't give rise to a constitutional tort.
But not a constitutional tort action.
Exactly. But my understanding of Monell liability is that the argument would be the same, and in the case of the council, if they are a final policymaker, we still would submit that they were acting in contravention of their established policy. And here it's even more the case, because the parole board does not have the ability to pass regulations or to act in the arena of whether or not to rely on impermissible hearsay testimony. Now, if I can...
But the chair did?
No, Your Honor. So the mayor delegated to the chairwoman of the board the authority to promulgate regulations subject to a passive review period by the council. So we don't think that the chairperson is actually a final policymaking authority for purposes of this case either. However, even
because,
if she...
Because it's subject to council review or something inherent in the...
Because board? It's subject to council review. But even if she were the appropriate final policymaking authority, she was not exercising the power of the board. She had no power to overrule the board. It had to be two votes of a quorum of three that could decide whether to revoke or grant parole in a particular case. The chairperson had no authority to overrule those decisions if she thought they were improper. So that's another reason why we know that she wasn't exercising final policymaking authority, and indeed the board as a whole didn't have itself any delegated final policymaking authority. So I think this case is very simply resolved under Monell. However, if this court does not believe that this can be resolved on the Monell policy liability grounds, we believe that it should be remanded for a new trial on both liability and damages. The district court in this action granted summary judgment, taking this court's 2006 opinion as dispositive of the issue of whether or not Mr. Singletary had suffered a constitutional tort. We submit that that was incorrect. We have this court's decision finding that the parole was revoked on the basis of insufficient hearsay testimony, and in granting Mr. Singletary a new hearing on whether or not his parole should have been revoked. We submit that he received all the process to which he was entitled under this court's opinion in that second revocation hearing. But in any event, the district court, in conducting the inquiry on summary judgment, should have determined whether or not Mr. Singletary would have remained at liberty but for the due process violation in the first.
The second revocation hearing was when?
The second revocation hearing was in 2006.
And he'd been confined for how long at that point?
He had been confined for 10 years because he had a 9 to 27-year sentence on the underlying crimes, which involved him shooting one man in the face and then jumping out of a moving car in a second infraction, when he's being chased by police and firing a weapon or having a weapon. So that was a very long sentence from his original crimes, and so when his parole was revoked, he was obligated to serve to the state the remainder of that sentence. So the reason that there's been a 10-year lag is because, not because he was being held impermissibly for that time, but because he was serving the underlying sentence once his parole had been revoked.
No, but I mean, I guess the point is that he had gotten parole, and so he was out.
Right.
And then he goes back in, and then your argument is that there was no due process violation because 10 years later, after he went back in, he got a second chance with the revocation hearing?
There was no due process violation because he had a pre-deprivation hearing. It was one that this court later in the 2006 opinion held had some due process questions, and so this court then remanded it for a second parole revocation hearing. When he had that hearing, he doesn't take any issue with the result of that hearing, which resulted in his release back on parole. And in between the first parole revocation hearing and the second, he had three separate occasions to raise a habeas petition. And he had five courts, the Superior Court and the D.C. Court of Appeals in two instances and the D.C. District Court here, finding no constitutional problem with his parole revocation. And so we submit that the first parole hearing, the second parole hearing, and every intervening habeas decision gave him the process to which he was due.
So even if, for example, the first time there had been a policy in effect, and no court understood that there was a policy in effect that required there to be a finding of a due process violation until 10 years later some other court comes along and says so, you'd say as long as then there's a subsequent revocation hearing at some point that there was no due process violation in the first
I think we'd be on very different footing if that were the case, but I still think ultimately we would have the argument that this court's decision entitled him to a second parole revocation hearing, and that's what he received. But, of course, if he were to bring a Section 1983 action, even on the facts of that case, the district court's grant of summary judgment wouldn't have been appropriate because he still needed to establish that he would have been at liberty but for the due process violation that occurred during the first parole revocation hearing. And then at that hearing, the district would be entitled, or at that trial, the district would be entitled to put on evidence that he would have had his parole revoked anyway. And in doing so, we would have put on the live testimony of the individuals who were the hearsay declarants at the initial parole revocation hearing. We would have been able to bring in Carmelita Metz, who was incarcerated in Minnesota on a life sentence for her involvement in this murder. We could have called Terry Washington. We could have called Gary Barnes, the co-conspirator. So we would have been entitled to prove that his parole would have been revoked in the absence of any due process questions of how the hearing took place.
I mean, I guess all of which you could have done the first time around, but apparently didn't happen. I mean, I guess this whole argument is predicated on the notion that, and I understand that we only get here if we get past the Monell issue, but this whole argument is predicated on the notion that the D.C. Circuit's opinion the first time around did not find a due process violation.
Not necessarily. We don't take this court's decision as establishing a due process violation. We believe that the court held on the basis of an insufficient record that the government had not established that the parole would have been revoked in the absence of unreliable hearsay testimony, and so remanded it for a second parole revocation hearing.
But if
this were a definitive finding of this court that there was a due process violation, that doesn't establish a constitutional tort for purposes of 1983. That merely establishes that for purposes of habeas, he was entitled to a new revocation hearing. Mr. Singletary then still had to make out the elements of his constitutional tort claim, such that he would have remained at liberty but for the due process question in his original parole revocation hearing. At that point, this is where the district puts on evidence that his parole would have been revoked anyway. That's where we can call the witnesses, we can bring in Metz, we can subpoena Terry Washington. Had the second parole revocation hearing been under the district's auspices when it took place, we may have sought to bring in some of these witnesses. But by the time he was granted a second parole revocation hearing, the U.S. Parole Commission had taken over the actions of parole from the D.C. Parole Board. They had very different incentives. They weren't in privity with the D.C. Parole Board. They didn't have any reason to believe they would be on the hook for any Section 1983 liability. And also, so many years had passed that their incentives for holding Mr. Singletary on his parole violation were not as urgent. He only had 2 years left on his ultimate sentence, and so it wasn't worth the Parole Commission to go to the trouble of finding all these witnesses and taking on this burden. The district, in a trial for a constitutional tort, however, should be able to bring this evidence. I see that my time is up. Are there no further questions? Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor. Please, the court. Judge Srinivasan, let me see if I can answer your questions and turn to Judge Randolph's questions. And forgive me, because I'm a week out. I've had a cold for a week. Who put this process in motion? Charles Singletary did 10 years in jail for a crime he never committed. Who caused that to occur? It was the D.C. Board of Parole. Now, who was the D.C. Board of Parole? They had plenary decision-making authority, and we know from PEMBOR that decision-making authority is enough if you have the plenary authority. It was not subject to review by any executive or administrative branch. They admitted that in the record below, it's in their answers to interrogatories. They were not constrained by anybody else's policies. They had plenary decision-making authority. There was nobody else looking over their shoulders. It wasn't the City Council. The City Council wasn't a policymaker here. It was the D.C. Board of Parole, that now defunct agency, that caused Charles Singletary to lose 10 years of his life. They didn't violate their own policies, Judge Randolph. Morrissey versus Brewer says it's perfectly legitimate to consider hearsay in parole proceedings, in parole revocation. It has to be reliable hearsay. And here...
That's right. But the Supreme Court has said, as have circuit courts, that within the standard, within the words preponderance of the evidence, is a requirement that the evidence be reliable and probative. And so if the Board of Parole made a decision based on hearsay, of unreliable hearsay, they violated the preponderance of evidence rule that they were required to follow. So if that's the case, and it seems to me it is, then how can that possibly be laid at the feet of the District of Columbia government? The policy that was in place was exactly the opposite of what the parole board did.
Their policy said
so
nothing.
So that's why they were reversed.
That's right. They were reversed because they didn't comply with Supreme Court law. But if they don't comply with Supreme Court law, they have violated the Constitution. It's that simple. They didn't have a specific policy. It's in the record that said we can't consider hearsay.
Have a policy. If there wasn't a policy, how do you have a Monell case? How do you have municipal liability unless there's a policy?
If you're the decision maker, that's what PEMBOR talks about. Or in the case of Kropotnick, it talks about that if a chair has done what she did here.
A violation of the policy is not the same thing as making policy, is it, counsel?
It's a decision. Policy, does, as we all know, doesn't have to be a regulation, Judge Sintel. It can be a decision. It could be a decision that, in this case, unfortunately, was unconstitutional. It doesn't have the fact of the matter is it didn't violate a rule. Had it violated a rule, it would have been a different story.
It violated the preponderance of evidence standard.
Yeah.
That's the rule.
That's a judge-made rule, Your Honor.
It's part of the Board of Parole's rules.
It's part of the board. It has to be reliable evidence, Your Honor. And if they have erred and they made the decision that cost a man 10 years of his life, there's a remedy for that. A 1983 damages action, as Heck versus Humphrey tells us. It's Their rules were, to say the least, they were not clear. But they did say, we will consider and a determination of a preponderance of evidence in our discretion, we may violate you. That's what they did here. They determined that there was a preponderance of evidence that sufficed, and they were wrong.
It seems to me what's tricky about, what may be tricky about your position is that there is a body somewhere that can make policy about parole revocation decisions. But that body doesn't seem to be the board. So whatever decision the board made in an individual case, it's not entirely clear how that decision can be at the requisite level called for by the Supreme Court's decisions, because the way the city has delegated its authority over this area doesn't go to the board. It goes, at best, to the chair of the board. But in the first instance, it starts with the city council. And then somebody made this rule that Judge Randolph has been referring to. And then the question becomes, is a board decision the sort of thing that is at that level? And if it's not, then it's hard to attach liability to the city. If it is, then maybe liability to the city.
But the board isn't at the level. It gets to determine. It has the plenary decision-making authority here.
But it has plenary.
It doesn't have the authority to amend, alter, or disregard the rules that are binding on it. And the three members of the parole board that sat on the decision involving your client, not a one of them, neither. The chairman was not one of them.
The chair signed the order, Judge.
Yeah, but the chair was not on the three-member board that decided this case, right?
I think, Your Honor, first of all, the record shows there were two members of the board who heard it. But under the rules, the chair would participate, and then it was the full board. Let me I refer you to Joint Appendix 151.
Yeah, I looked at it. Maybe
you don't get violated without a sign-off by the board, and the chair signed that. If you look at page 151 of the Joint Appendix. Yes, Your Honor.
But the chair didn't have decision-making authority, right? Because the decision was made by two board members other than the chair.
Well, ultimately, though, it's a recommended decision, Judge Srinivasan. What has to happen under the regulations is the board has to concur. It could have been a recommendation by a board by a hearing examiner and a board member. If I remember correctly here, it was two board members, and then the third board member, which is the chair, concurred. And ultimately, and that was the decision that was issued.
But the chair doesn't have to participate.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. But the chair signed off. So in this case, to the extent that they take the position that the chair was the ultimate decision maker, that's a formality, but the chair signed off on it.
But it seems to me that can happen a lot where, for example, if you have a body that makes a decision, you might have some kind of official ratification of the decision by a policymaking official.
But unless that
policymaking official was actually involved in the decisional enterprise, the fact that they kind of memorialize it in the notice that's given to the affected individual wouldn't then make the entire decision into one that's attributable to the city.
Right, but in this case, Judge Srinivasan, we didn't have two lower echelon employees. We had three members of the board that concurred and decided that Mr. Singletary's parole should be violated unconstitutionally. It wasn't lower level people. It's not a respondeat superior case. It's the board. There were three members of the board. That's who concurred, that's who voted, and that's who illegally took Mr. Srinivasan away. Now the fact
Singletary. Just to be clear.
I mean, Your Honor, Mr. Singletary.
I just want to make sure nothing happened to me that I wasn't aware of.
I apologize.
No.
But the fact of the matter is, what they violated was the Constitution. They didn't violate any specific rule or regulation. You violate the Constitution.
They violated the rule of evidence, which in this particular instance had constitutional effect. But what they did is violate a rule of evidence.
Constitutional rule.
Is there any case you know of anywhere where any municipality or other governmental defendant has been held liable in constitutional tort for violating a rule of evidence?
This looks like
a judicial function they're performing here, doesn't it?
Well, no, it's not, Your Honor, because let me explain. First of all, most of the time when you have something like this, you're talking about state actors. Most of the cases that have arisen in this area have been state actor cases, so the 11th Amendment disposed of that quickly enough. In a case such as this, the D.C. is a municipality. Mm-hmm. A municipality, as we know from Owen, as we know from Leatherman, as we know from the court's decision in Haynesworth, doesn't enjoy judicial immunity, although they tried to argue for it here. They don't have any case that says that. So the answer
is... Do you have any case that says a body functioning like this parole board does not have quasi-judicial immunity?
I am having trouble hearing you on
that. I'm sorry. Do you not... Is there any case that says that a parole board does not have quasi-judicial immunity? I mean, I understand you're saying that nobody says that a municipality...
Well, they're not a court. In this particular... No,
that's why I put the quasi in there. You heard the quasi, didn't you, Counsel?
And, Your Honor, I think there are plenty... Let's talk about a Seventh Circuit case they talk about, a case called Hernandez versus mm-hmm. Sheehan. Hernandez says the same thing, that there's no difference between quasi and absolute immunity.
Who was the defendant in Hernandez?
I'm sorry?
What was the defendant's role in Hernandez?
There was an issue of quasi-judicial immunity that arose in that, and they said that there's no quasi-judicial immunity.
I didn't understand that to answer my question. What was the role of that defendant who did not have quasi-judicial immunity?
I don't remember, Your Honor.
He was not a parole board, was he?
It was not a parole board.
A prosecutor, wouldn't it?
Sir?
It was a prosecutor.
Well, under Haynesworth versus Miller, prosecutors and the municipality don't enjoy judicial immunity.
Right. Now we're talking about parole boards. Do you have any case that has something analogous to a parole board that decides against the board on that question?
What?
There may not be any for it either, but the lack of authority may be on both sides.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but I would also point this out, that what we have here is a city agency, an administrative agency, and I refer you to Andre JMW. The District of Columbia Court of Appeals said in Andre JMW that once a court has concluded with its role and a defendant has been sentenced, that after that point it returns to the executive branch. And that, in this particular case, is where the decision-making authority rested. It rested in the executive branch. It was then delegated to the parole board. There was no further right of review past the parole board.
Are you saying there's no such thing as quasi-judicial immunity, or that this board doesn't?
In this case, there's no quasi-judicial immunity, because that would be inconsistent.
Are you saying there is no such thing?
No, I'm saying there is such a thing.
Who does have quasi-judicial immunity, then?
Your Honor?
Who does have quasi-judicial, in your view, what does quasi-judicial immunity protect? Who does it protect?
In my view, if you're suing the individual, they have quasi-judicial immunity. We didn't sue the individual. No individual got sued here. Who got sued was the District of Columbia government. No parole board members were sued individually, or for that matter, in their official capacity. The District of Columbia was sued for the action of the Board of Parole. The people that get judicial immunity
are
the individuals.
So that sounds like respondent superior, doesn't it? You're saying respondent superior is the basis of your liability, then, aren't you?
Your Honor, I'm saying. The problem is...
You said earlier you were not suing under respondent superior theory.
I said that day one.
Right. That's now right. You seem to be falling back on respondent superior. When
oh,
you
I
say,
never said that.
Well, if they have quasi-judicial immunity, it doesn't matter because we're suing their superior.
I'm trying to answer your question, Judge. You asked
I know,
me to ask
you're really not satisfying me very well with how you're doing it.
I'm sorry, but my view is who has quasi-judicial immunity are individuals who are sued, and we don't want their pockets to be taken. We don't want them to be fearful. That's the reason there's quasi-judicial immunity. Individuals. We're not talking about individuals here. We're talking about the District of Columbia government.
So if a judge is sued, and the judge asserts judicial immunity, would you then say you could go after the government for who writes the paycheck for that judge?
No, I wouldn't. Well, first of all, if we were talking, you have to tell me who we're talking about. If we're talking about the state, we certainly have...
No, a superior court judge across the
state. In that case, we have a Rooker-Feldman problem, don't we? But this isn't a Rooker-Feldman problem because we have a District of Columbia executive agency. It's a one-off
type
thing.
I think you're reasoning in a circle, Counsel.
Your Honor... We're not suing a judge. Mm-hmm. We're not suing a judicial official. We're
right.
Suing the District of Columbia government and for the act
for
of
the
executive.
Act of a member of the parole board. I ask you about the possible quasi-judicial immunity. Right. You said, well, it doesn't apply because we're suing the municipality that employs the board rather than the board.
Right. That's what
I asked you, well, then, if you were suing for something that a court did, a judge did, could you bypass the judge because of his judicial immunity and go straight against the employing government? And you said, no, you couldn't. If it the quasi-judicial immunity is the same as judicial immunity, except it's an official instead of it has a different title than judge, what's the difference?
There's a major difference. Owen versus City of Independence, Leatherman versus Tarrant, Haynesworth versus Miller, and a host of cases. Judicial immunity, this isn't immunity exists to protect individuals. Municipalities do not enjoy
So then, if that reasoning is what you're relying on, why couldn't you sue the District of Columbia over the act of a Superior Court judge?
Because, as I said to you just a moment ago, Judge Sintel, you would, in that case, you would have a judicial immunity situation, and secondly, you would have a Rooker versus Feldman situation.
In this case, I'm asking you to assume you have a quasi-judicial immunity.
I am saying to you, in this case, there's no absolute and no quasi-judicial immunity, Judge Sintel. The fact of the matter is you have an executive branch agency. That's what Unway JMW tells us.
But don't you have to, it seems to me, I think what Judge Sintel is getting at is that you have to draw some kind of distinction between judicial immunity and whatever kind of immunity you think applies here, because I take it that, would you take the position that because of Owen in these cases that draw a distinction between the individual immunity that attaches to the particular officer who takes a decision and the body that oversees, and that would mean that a judge, even though a judge has judicial immunity, that the municipality could be sued for the judge's actions that violate the Constitution?
I said I don't think the municipality could be sued under those circumstances because of Rooker versus Feldman.
I don't know what Rooker Feldman has to do with that. Rooker Feldman has to do with review. But on the question of whether the suit can proceed as a Monell suit, would you take the position that in a case that involves an action of a judge, as to which the judge has absolute immunity, the action nonetheless could be taken against the municipality?
I would say that would be an extremely difficult case, to put it mildly. You would have all sorts of barriers. You would have a Heck versus Humphrey barrier. Again, you would have a Rooker-Feldman barrier because you would be essentially questioning the acts of a state court, or in this case, a city court. And that's a Rooker-Feldman situation. So I don't think you'd ever have to get to that, as Judge Cola-Catelli pointed out in her decision. When she denied the district's motion to dismiss, in her opinion, I believe it's 685 F sub 2nd, she talked about the issue of quasi-judicial immunity, and she said it doesn't apply here. It's not in this particular case because the Board of Parole, A, was an executive agency, B, because there are a host of other barriers to suing, chiefly, you have a situation where there are state actors. We're not suing state actors here. We sue the District of Columbia. There's no 11th Amendment immunity issue.
Okay.
I'm happy to respond to any further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. So Ms. Alicon's out of time, I believe, but we'll give you 2 minutes to wrap up rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I have 3 points on rebuttal. All actually are answers to Judge Sintel's questions. So first, every regional circuit and the D.C. Court of Appeals has held that the parole board is entitled to quasi-judicial immunity for their actions in granting or revoking parole. Next, Mr. Lacar said that you wouldn't be able to get around judicial immunity by suing the district. And the recent DDC case in Sebeshi confirms that. There, the plaintiff had sued Superior Court judges and the district, and Judge Belasberg, dismissing the suit, held that the district was entitled to the quasi-judicial immunity that the judges would have also received. And finally, the Hernandez case, you were asking who the relevant actors were. It was the sheriff's department had detained someone because they had accidentally put their driver's license number into the computer incorrectly, and they pulled up someone with a similar name, same birthday, and same appearance as the person they had an outstanding warrant for. So they dragged that person in and incarcerated him. He tried to say, you have the wrong person, it isn't me, and it fell on deaf ears. What the Seventh Circuit held there was that the city did not have a policy of acting in this regard, and so therefore they were entitled to immunity. It did remand for some questions about whether the sheriff's department could be held liable because it had repeatedly denied his claims that he was not actually the person who should have been incarcerated. But what's relevant there is that the city was not on the hook because they had no policy of acting unconstitutionally. Similarly here, the district has no policy or custom of revoking parole on unreliable hearsay or otherwise insufficient evidence. And that alone is dispositive under Monell. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alicon. The case is submitted. The court will take a short recess before the next argument.